Good morning. Okay, first off, welcome to the What's the Temp podcast. We are so delighted to be with you today. My name is Bettina, and I am coming in hot.
That's a really good one. And I'm Jen, and I'm checking in so I don't check out.
Love it. How are you today?
I'm fantastic.
That is so good to hear. So good.
I am fabulous.
Well, let's get right into the title of today's episode. You want to start?
Yeah. What is it?
The title of today's episode is Sobriety and Clarity. And I'm so excited about this one because we recently discovered that I, even though I, you know, didn't really indulge in drugs and alcohol like that. But I had my own personal levels of insobriety, and that resulted in a lot of the things, the negative experiences that I was having in my life. So I'm excited about this episode. How about you?
I'm really excited about it. My favorite topic ever is emotional sobriety. Mm-hmm. In this season of my life, I am obsessed with emotional sobriety.
Love it. Love it. And I want you to define that for me. Like, what is emotional sobriety?
So the concept of sobriety that I have been taught is that it is my maintenance of my spiritual condition on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an expression called off the beam. Mm-hmm. So off the beam means I'm out of balance. Signs that I might be out of balance for me include the number one sign for me is repetitive thinking. Usually my thoughts are flowing down the river. They're moving forward. They're not repeating too much. But then sometimes all of a sudden, you know, when you're, I don't know if you've ever been whitewater rafting, but there's these things in rivers called eddies. And it's when the water is just circling, like a little tornado, a cyclone. Mm-hmm. So when I get caught, the biggest flag for me is that my thoughts will start looping. So instead of like, oh, I talked to Bettina and then I moved on with my day, it'll be like, oh, that part of that conversation, it'll just start looping.
Mm-hmm.
Another way I might know I'm off the beam is I have a resentment. So I recently had a resentment against not my boss, but someone at work. And I was having a full-blown conversation with this man at 3 a.m. in my bed. That's off the beam.
That's off the Richter scale.
Yeah, I'm not sleeping. I'm just like, and then he would have said this, and then I would have been like, and it's like, go to sleep, you know? I get caught. I get twisted up. And then it's just, it can be behavior. So if I'm short-tempered, that would be a lack of emotional sobriety, but it's selfishness, screwing people over, it's anger, it's anything that is not aligned with balance or, you know, spirituality, peace, calm, integrity, grace, all those good words, that's on the beam. And then, like we said in the previous episode, I define addiction as habits that imprison the spirit.
Yeah. And that can be anything.
Anything.
I get that.
Overworking, over-exercising, overeating, over-shopping, gambling.
Over anything.
Over-analyzing. That's a big one I'm guilty of.
I saw a video recently on YouTube where it was these guys that were doing this amazing jump, and it was like a double jump. So they jumped in the air, and then while they were in the air, they were able to press down and then jump higher without touching the ground. So it was like a total gravity-defying thing, right? And then when you go to the comments, because I'm thinking, this is amazing. This is amazing. And the caption basically said, so gravity just left this post because he doesn't even understand what's happening here, right? right? And then somebody said, and then after at the bottom of the caption, it says, please explain this to me. And then one of the funniest comments in the comment section was, my mom could explain because she's always jumped to conclusions.
Yes.
I thought about myself because I spent so much time in the past jumping to conclusions. I don't do it now, but it reminded me of the old me, you know, where I was,
yes.
I never had all the facts. I never waited to hear the other person's side of the story. But baby, by the time we spoke, I had jumped to 50 levels of different conclusions about what happened with that totally, possibly innocent situation. And yeah, so it was hilarious to me. But I want us to jump into our temperature check for today because I love, love, love to see how you're feeling. And so today's temperature check is personal growth markers. What are your personal growth markers? So tell me how you're feeling. Like, give me your temperature. And then along with that, give me your personal growth markers. That's hilarious.
I'm unprepared
the fact
for
that you laughed. The fact that you laughed is everything.
I'm so unprepared. I know, because I forgot to think about it. temperature, sunny and 83, baby.
Love it.
Sunny and 83. I'm feeling toasty. I'm feeling calm. I did not get much sleep last night, but I just decided to roll with it. I decided everything is okay. I caught this extra hour. And I just woke up saying, I'll take it.
I love taking your power back on this with this missing sleep at time.
Because you can't always get all the sleep you need. But it's an attitude adjustment. I always go into fear immediately if I don't get enough sleep. And I'm just changing that narrative. Speaking of narratives and conclusions and reading into things, I'm just deciding that my narrative is I'm good.
I love that.
I'm good.
So let's talk about your personal growth markers.
Well, off the top of my head, I did. So the reason why I was up last night is I was trying to help out with setting up the Zoom meeting. And when I get my little mind on something, this is probably a good sign of not totally being on the beam, but I think it's one of those assets that slides over into the liability column from time to time. I can get very obsessive with something. Mm-hmm. If I'm trying to do something and I get stuck, I'll just latch on. I am like a pit bull with a problem-solving situation. So I had a setting that I needed where I would disable people's video by default, but that they couldn't turn it on. And I needed that to exist, and it didn't exist. So I was just, you know, banging my head against the wall, like going to Reddit, trying to figure out, is there a workaround? Is there whatever? And I was up for 2 hours trying to figure out how to get these settings right for this meeting. And then in the morning, I let someone else take credit for it. So I think that's a sign of growth.
Wow.
So the guy who was leading the meeting, he's like, well, I guess what I did on the settings last night worked out perfectly.
Oh.
And I was like, yeah.
You did, sir. You really did. You did that, sir.
Yeah. So normally my ego is so big that I would need that recognition. I would need that validation. I just thrive on praise and validation. And I just gave it to God. Gave it up.
That's a form of letting go, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, I don't need that. I am good today. I have enough.
And I feel like it also stems from right now. I feel like it also stems from your own validation, because you know what you're doing behind the scenes to improve yourself, your life, and the existence of your family. So you didn't need that little, I'm not going to, you know, diminish it, but that little petty validation on that Zoom call this morning. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm making real steps out here in these personal growth streets, sir.
Yes. And then I thought of another one, actually, just as you were saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So my work life right now is a nightmare. Everything that I feared coming back from maternity leave has come true. They've completely changed my responsibilities. I am doing a lot more work for not any more pay at this moment. I'm choosing work over my kids, which is something I swore I would never do. And I feel that I don't have a choice. So I'm working nights and I'm working sometimes on the weekends. And I'm the type of person that I would never trade my time for money more than was absolutely necessary. Like if they came to me tomorrow and said, we'll give you $30,000 more, but you have to work 10 more hours a week, I would say no, thank you. Mm-hmm. Because my reasoning is that I might be able to take a vacation that's twice as nice. Maybe I wouldn't be looking for the budget hotel or whatever if I had more income. But you only take a vacation, you know, once, twice max a year. My life is now. My life is in the everyday. So I don't want to work more hours every day. For what?
Right.
I don't want more money. I feel fine with the money I have, and I have enough. So if my mentality is I'm already living in abundance, I don't need to have more on top of that. I have enough to pay the bills. It's a little bit tight right now with two kids in daycare, obviously, but I do have enough.
Right.
So I've been miserable, hating life. Just, I mean, that's not the growth marker, obviously. Self-pity isn't part of it. But then the good thing is, though, so in I always notice just I think about what was I like before. And what I was like before is that if there was even one stain on the panoramic window of life, that stain would just bleed across the whole picture. That mm-hmm. It was just that one. It was such an all or nothing proposition. If there was one thing wrong, it would just take the whole thing down. It was a house of cards. So now I can have those moments where, you know, every time I would come upstairs to get water or to get whatever, yesterday Herschel was home and I was like, I hate this. I'm dying. I need to close my eyes. I'm so drained. I'm so tired. It's just, I hate this. And then, but then by the time the evening came, I didn't let it ruin my evening. I just said, okay, now I'm being fully present in this moment. We brought home halal from the city yesterday. I brought home halal from the city yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I was just like loving life, sitting on the couch, watching whatever. I don't even remember watching and eating halal and just living large, you know. So I think I'm getting better at being present in the moment I'm in. So yeah, I am hating work right now. It's kind of miserable. But then I can transition and say, okay, now I'm in this other headspace and now I'm enjoying this moment. And that's something I've been striving for a long time. How about you, though? What are your, let me turn it around on you. What's your temp? What's your growth markers?
So I'm in the middle of a stretch right now because this is the part where normally people that have like New Year's resolutions, this is where they fall all the way off the bandwagon. And so I'm in that part where my goals are becoming real. Like I said, I've completed the first of 4 books for the year, which that actually gives me the energy to keep going. So if I wanted to take my temperature, I would say that I'm about a 65, which is lower than my normal. It's lower than my normal, but still good, if that makes sense. I feel good because I'm still pushing through. My struggle right now is learning some flexibility because this week I've been feeling a little bit robotic because I go and go and go relentlessly. And I do. And it's everybody's noticing it. And so what I'm thinking about, you know how I take a vision and then I try to reverse engineer it, like the things that we do for work, how I say, okay, this is where we want to be. So if launch day is going to be this day, then let me reverse engineer all the things that have to be done leading up to that so that we can make sure that that day is perfect, right? I do that for my life. I do that for all the big things that I want to achieve. I do that if I'm going to throw a dinner party. And so right now, I need to reverse engineer what my next relationship is going to look like. The robotic thought came to me like, you just don't stop. When I look at the month and, you know, it's towards the end of the month. And so I'm just thinking like, okay, already before we get to the actual end of the month, I'm thinking, okay, am I winning the month in all these 89 categories, right? Am I winning the month? And so it begins to look and feel robotic, especially when, remember we talked about last week, my manicure, pedicure, it still isn't done. It's still not
prioritized.
I did not prioritize it. All I've done is taken the polish off. But as far as applying new and cleaning up the cuticles, it's still not done.
Listen, it's progress, not perfection.
It is. But what I'd love to see, and so I thought about, okay, what do I want my relationship to be like? And I said, I still want to be an achiever. I still want to be very goal oriented, but I would love to have that person that knows how to bring me out of that go, go, go place with love. And like, I want to create an atmosphere at my home that's like sexy go. You know what I mean? Where it's like we create this amazing space together. We're intimate. Even when we're cooking dinner, we're intimate, even if, you know, I'm grooming his beard or whatever it is, there's a level of intimacy because there's a closeness and a connection. But at the same time, when I'm working, I want to have that uninterrupted freedom to accomplish the things I need to accomplish. But then when I'm done, I want to be done and I want to be in this safe space that is so all-encompassing. So my growth markers are, one of my growth markers is thinking about that, because I've never thought about the flexibility so much. I thought of life, instead of appreciating it as a journey, I thought of life as a whole bunch of things to check off and do for the last several years.
Story of my life. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is have the flexibility to create and to achieve, but then to still enjoy exactly where I am in the journey, to still have the connection with the people that I love, to make time for the things that are important to you in real life. So that's one major growth marker. And then the other is just, I feel like spiritual growth, I'm there. Accountability wise, I feel that that even goes into that part of the flexibility, you know, where I'm able to be accountable, I'm able to be transparent, I'm able to be open about the wins and the losses, where before my ego always wanted to show the wins. And so that was also the fuel for why I would go so hard on a day-to-day, because again, I wasn't going to be the one that was the, you know, low man on the totem pole, you know? And so I feel like I'm growing in appreciating life on a day-to-day versus every moment being used to achieve or to conquer, you know? I think that's going to serve me well going forward.
But every now and then you gotta pause. Ask yourself, is this right? Stand your ground.
A question for you. So one of the ways that we're opposites, this is just a running theme, is this is one way, this crazy motivational level that you seem to always be on. So when I have a free day, my first thought process is 10 episodes of Law and Order SVU, get the blanket, get the snacks. Like, I'm couch bound. That's my dream. I never quite get there, but every time I have some day off or some unstructured day, the first thing I think is, what can I marathon? What type of food can I get up in here? And whenever I'm talking to you, and you have relative freedom in your schedule compared to me, but you are always balls to the wall, achieving, striving. What is motivating you? What's the fire inside you that keeps you striving and, you know, conquering? What is it? What's driving that?
It's a couple of things. I have to change the narrative. So when I started out like a complete a-hole, causing problems. I had my kids early, so that was like a shame thing. I'm using air quotes because I'm not ashamed of my children. That was a shame thing. And then I got into trouble in my 20s, so that was even more shameful and even degrading. And then, so then I've just been through a lot of things, and I felt that because I didn't have like the leadership and the love and the compassion and the grace that a lot of people have, like, I feel like if someone noticed when I was a teenager that I had the potential to be a high achiever, that someone with the proper pedigree, and I had a couple of them around me, that someone with the proper pedigree could have said, let me take this girl under my wings and help her realize the potential that's on the inside of her. Instead, I went to a family member who had an amazing business in the city. And I was like, can I just answer phones? And I had gone to Learners to get my little business outfit, honey. I was so ready. And I went and I was like, I just want to learn business, and you're doing such an amazing thing. And is it possible if I could just answer your phones? I'll do it for free just to understand what you're doing and to get an idea. And she told me, girl, get your college degree and you can come and work for me. And it was a close family member. So it was a total shun. It was a total shun.
Oh, my heart is breaking for little shining star Bettina.
I know. It's really one of those things. So for me, I'm going to cry right now. You're making me cry, Jen.
I'm going to cry right now because I can just only imagine, like, this little person so full of promise and so just knowing the motivation levels you have, and then this person just casting you to the side and putting that huge, getting a college degree. What? That is a huge bar to doing anything. Don't get a college degree. Get to work.
Yeah.
What's that person's problem? How could they look at that little person and just throw them away?
Yeah. So what I wanted... What drives me is becoming what I needed, you know, for all those years. When I think about the teenager, when I think about the young adult, when I think about the you know, adult, I've always wanted to become what I needed. And so if I could be an example or just a vision of hope for someone going through my old experiences, then I'll take that on. And it starts with my own family right now. And so I don't feel like I'm there yet. I feel like I have a voice. I feel like I have some amazing information. I feel like I have the compassion and the grace and the heart, but I still want receipts because a lot of people respond to receipts. So when you ask what's my motivator, it's that.
Sometimes I want to give all of me. Sometimes I want to scream, oh my God.
How old were you when that happened with asking for the job and someone telling you to get a degree?
I was 14.
Oh, that's such a delicate age.
Yeah, I feel like the trajectory of my life changed after that.
Wow.
So
that hurts.
Yeah.
That hurts my heart.
Yeah. So I just didn't want another child that had that kind of potential, that was, you know, just innately smart and just had so much possibility, just a light on her or him. I don't want another child to have to be turned away if I could just become a voice of authority, of possibility, you know, for these kids or these young adults. I would graciously become that. And I just have this feeling that when I'm in this hidden space, before there's a light shined on me, I have to achieve mastery. Because once the light is on me, once there's the potential for influence, once there's, you know, people, you know, wanting what you have, there's no time to prepare. So what you see is me preparing for when the podcast takes off, when, you know, my speaking engagements take off, when something that I create goes viral, then I want to already be equipped, like full of all the information that I've wanted to share with the world forever. And I finally get this opportunity to do it. And now when I speak, it comes off as masterful because in the hidden space, I literally was focusing on mastery. That's what drives me.
So my next question is, I love the way you speak about being what you need. So being that the topic is sobriety and clarity, is that what the topic is?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. I don't know why I don't.
It's okay.
My next question is, in the past, so I'm thinking about this 14-year-old, and my heart is just breaking because 14, it is such a formative time. I always think, so I was eighth grade when I was 14. I think you turned 14 in eighth grade. And that's the first year I remember feeling like a full-fledged human being.
Yeah, around that
time. You know,
time.
And
yeah.
I remember feeling a real sense of self-actualization. Like, I had crushes on people and I had best friends and my feelings were really easily hurt and I felt depression and anxiety, which I couldn't name, you know, and it was a time of turmoil. And so that's why it feels so acute me putting myself into your shoes, because just for a 14-year-old to put themselves out there like that.
Right?
Oh my gosh. Can you? I mean, 14-year-olds are surly and they isolate, you know? So it's like that, just to kind of like, I'm just imagining for some reason you putting on like little heels, you know? And
kitten heels, honey.
Yeah, like something business casual. Like, it's just, you know, obviously I want to know exactly what you were wearing if you feel like you want to share it, if you remember it. But then the crash of rejection, because when you're a teenager, your hormones are just surging. But then also in addition to that, a lot of these feelings are new feelings.
And everything seems bigger than it actually is. Do you remember that being a teenager?
Yes, but it is big. I don't even think it's bigger than it is. I think it's big because you have never experienced it before. So it takes over your whole consciousness because you are experiencing everything so fully.
Yeah.
I don't know
absolutely.
How teenagers are now. Are they different because of phones now?
I just think that they don't even bother to put themselves out there. Most of them are hiding.
Yeah. And I was hiding too, but I didn't have a screen to look at while I was doing it, you know?
Right.
So my question is, I'm deeply empathizing with that little girl, because when you're that age, you feel like you're an adult. But then when I see someone who's 14, I'm like, oh, baby, you know,
yes.
Like they're so little, but they're not. I remember feeling really like a, you know, not an adult, but a young adult at that age. Very complex time. But my question is, for all those years that you, because you had kids, did you have three before you were 20, or were you 20 when you had three?
I was 20 when I had three. So between 20 and 21, I had the third one.
Okay. So 16, you had your first child.
Mm-hmm.
By 20, you're a single, basically widow. Is it widow or widower?
Mm-hmm.
Whichever one the woman is, of
widow.
Three young children.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And now, meanwhile, you were never really cultivated.
No.
Your potential was never cultivated. And now you have three little ones to care for, but also you haven't even been raised.
Yep. Yep. And it was because there was so much going on in the household that I was looking for like a place to escape to. And for me, the first choice was escaping into business, escaping into a place where I could cultivate this potential. Because what I saw was people that didn't speak like me, because I was such an avid reader as a child and as a teenager, I had a broad vocabulary, much more. I've forgotten, like at 52, I've forgotten half the words I used to use, right? But I had such a broad vocabulary and I just, it was like I would escape to books. And so I saw the world as so much bigger than what was my experience. And I was willing to do the work to be able to step out into and realize or experience that world. And so my first thought was, let me escape to business. Let me use the spare time that I have into learning how to become what I think is possible for me. Make sense?
Yeah.
And so when that didn't happen, everything felt so hopeless. It was like, I'm just doomed to what's happening in this house. You know what I mean? I'm doomed to, I wasn't loved. I was basically a hard worker. I was cooking for kids. I was bathing kids, getting kids ready for school, cleaning, and all of that stuff. You always talk about, you know, when we talk about these recipes and cooking, I ended up loving it because it's literally a love language for me. But for years, I hated it because I was made to do it. You know what I mean? I hated it. Mm-hmm. But it became, because I had kids, I didn't get to hate it. You still have to cook for them. So I literally went from parenting my siblings to parenting my own children in a very, very short time. And so there was never, and I think that's why I appreciate this time and this space of me now where, you know, being an empty nester and only having to focus on me because that's just never been a thing in my life.
Yeah.
No one ever knows where we're heading, where this story goes. You just gotta own on to your path, what feels right in your heart and your soul.
So let me zoom in before I zoom out to the question.
Okay.
First of all, where did you grow up and how many siblings did you have?
In Los Angeles, and then I had 4 total siblings.
Where in Los Angeles?
In South Central. So we were on like 43rd and Avalon, and I don't even know if you would know where that is.
Is that near Pico?
So you're looking at like in the Crenshaw. It's like east of Crenshaw. I don't know if you would know where that is, but it's South Central Los Angeles.
It's between downtown and the west side.
It is. It is between downtown and the west side, yes.
Okay. And how many siblings did you have?
4.
4. Okay. Brothers, sisters?
Yeah, 1 sister, 3 brothers.
So I did not know that, actually.
No?
I didn't know the makeup of your siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So you're 20 years old, or I guess we can span 14. You try to put yourself out there. You hit a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
And then you spend the next X number of years or maybe even decades wanting to be what you need and to give yourself what you need, but going about it in all the wrong ways / unable to do so. Why?
Right. And what it was, I felt like I was in this situation. I was always in a situation of desperation because I had... So it was like having a view of what it's supposed to look like and having not a step of a bridge on how to get there. So it was like I had this big picture in my mind, but I didn't have anyone to help me build the bridge to get there. And so I was constantly on this road of, I'm going to try and realize that for these children. I'm going to try and realize that for myself. And so as a very young person, I got my own apartment with no real way to pay rent. Like I had a little job at a check cashing place. And I wrote about this in my first book. And that money wasn't enough money to cuss a cat, girl. And so I, you know, was always like struggling to pay the rent. So it's like, and when you're in that survival mode, I was explaining this to my daughter recently because things are so crazy. This is the federal employee. Things are so crazy with her job. And I said, you've been able to live in peace all these years. And now with things being so crazy, when you're in survival mode, you can't think clearly. You cease to enjoy your days and you're constantly stressing because you're constantly thinking about how am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? And what happens when you're in that space? You can't get the divine downloads that are necessary to help you navigate the things in life that you're facing. And so then you're constantly trying to do it yourself and you're just going around this mulberry bush and it's just tragedy after tragedy, issue after issue. That was pretty much a sign of my life for probably, I don't know, 20 years, 15 years, you know? So it was really, really hard. It was hard. And so even when I had the good job when I was in dentistry, I didn't know. I didn't have the money lessons and the knowledge for how to maintain it and grow it and, you know, steward it properly.
Oh, yeah.
It was like getting my paycheck and putting it in a purse with holes in it. You know, so the kids had what they needed. Like they always say to me now that they're responsible for their own insurances and responsible for their health and responsible for all their gas and their overhead, their rent and all these things and saving. They're like, Mom, how did you do this? And I'm like, not well. It looked good to you, but baby, I was a hot mess on the inside, you know? So, because they never went without a lot. We just moved a lot based on whatever my job was, you know, where my new job was taking me or whatever. But it was interesting.
So, what did emotional insobriety look like in your life? Paint us a picture.
It looked like, for me, being willing to do scammy stuff. Like, I was always looking for an easy out. So if I knew I needed to spend $700 on school clothes, I had the money, but it was going to deplete all the reserves. There would be really nothing left. And I just like, okay, I've whittled this list down. If I just got, you know, each person this many pairs of shoes, this many shirts, this many pairs of pants, then, you know, I could make it. But then winter's coming. So I need to prepare in advance for the jackets and the, you know, the accessories and then the hair, you know. And so it was all of that. And so when someone came and said, oh, well, you can buy a gift card for me and just give me half of it, my silly behind, not even finishing the thought to say that gift card is stolen, you know, and your happy tail could be in jail when you go and redeem the gift card, you know, not even fully thinking it through. It was such a silly time for me, you know, and so I would do it. I was like, okay, bring it. Tell them to bring it. I'll buy it. You know, and I would never do anything like that today. It's like, I don't care if I had the money or not. I'm like, no, I don't want no parts of it, you know, because I don't. So it was that for me. Or there was always like a risk around the corner, you know, risking your stability, risking your freedom. There was always a risk. And I felt like that came from hood living. And so the first thing that I wanted to do when the kids were growing up was make sure that they didn't live in the hood, because I felt like in the neighborhood or in the lower income areas was the idea that fat thinking was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I never wanted my kids to adopt that mentality. My whole thing was making sure that their experiences were different from those of my brothers and I.
I know you always want to do what's right. I know you rather want to fly than fight.
How was it normalized for you, that type of behavior, that way of living? where you grew up, like, who were you modeling that based on? Was it relatives? Was it just people in the neighborhood, people at school? Like, how did that become normalized for you?
So anyone that you saw in the neighborhood that was appearing to live comfortably or appearing to have it all. They could dress the way they wanted to dress. They could drive the way they wanted to drive. They had, you know, these were the people that never worried about how they were going to pay their rent or pay their mortgage. Those people were always in some form of crime. And so crime was normalized for my brothers and I. My sister was the second to the youngest. So when I talk about my brothers and I, I'm talking about the two brothers underneath me. I was the oldest child. Mm-hmm. So myself and my two brothers, while we never did crime together, we individually did stupid things. And so, but it was normalized because everyone that was stable, everyone that just appeared to have it all in our neighborhood and in the surrounding areas were in some form of crime.
So they were openly in crime, or you just knew that about them?
We knew it. It was open. Like, if you lived in a neighborhood, you know, oh, he sells big drugs over there. Oh, okay. This person robs banks for lunch every day. Or gotcha. This person, it was that kind of stuff. This house was, you know, where all the hoes live over here, you know. but they didn't worry about. They drove nice cars and they dressed well and their hair was always done. And so it just looked like, and then we were like welfare kids. And so it just looked like, and while, now here's the thing, I hate to say welfare kids, that was how what sustained us, but my mom was really a homemaker. So it was like, we didn't suffer. Like there was a time, a rough time in the early years, but she was a couponer. So we had food to the extreme. We could feed people in our neighborhood, and she did a lot, right? So we had a nice house. It was a big house. It was my grandmother's house. We had a nice house. It was a big house. We had rooms. We had nice furnishings and things like that. So it wasn't, when I say welfare kids, don't think project kids, you know? Mm-hmm. We had nice stuff. And so it was nice enough. And instead of us being able to just appreciate, and I feel like the reason we couldn't appreciate our home, I don't think it was because the accoutrements. I feel like it was the lack of love that made us always look outside for more. We were looking for love in all the wrong places. That's where we were as children.
That's relatable. Tell me more.
In my house, I learned that love was finite. I wrote something in a book recently where it was as, I wish I'd known we were going to speak about this because I would read you a short, short excerpt, but I actually want to hold
you on. You should. I just want to tell you that when you said that, my heart just sank into my bottom pit, into my stomach. When you said love is finite, ugh, what a message to grow up with.
Yeah, it was as if there just wasn't enough to go around. And so what happened was, as each new child arrived, the older ones were kind of discarded. And that's heartbreaking.
Just as they reach the age where they need it the most, where they need to navigate things. Yeah.
That was heartbreaking.
Oh my God, my heart is breaking.
So I'm going to find this piece because I really want to share it with you.
Please do. The suspense. I'm like sitting here on the edge of my seat.
Okay, I found it. So I know you don't want the whole thing because I think this is like 1,400 words. But what I will give you is just the first two paragraphs, which are not long.
Okay.
So this is an excerpt from my adventure book, which does not have a name, but I call it The Adventure of My Life. And it says, Glory spawned from parents she was convinced were monsters. She vowed she would parent differently if ever given the opportunity. She had a mother who wanted love, but for her entire life failed to realize it as an act of reciprocity. She took and took and took some more. She had a father with a brilliant mathematician for a dad who in the 1950s had children by two illiterate sisters. Her father knew no love. He was raised in abject poverty, living on welfare and survival mode. Her father was vilified from a young age, partly because of his jet black skin and partly because of his violent streak. He beat every woman he dated. When her mother was 16, she met him fresh out of jail. And while Glory was never told what he was in for, she heard countless tales of him beating her mom black and blue and administering the same violence on the mother of her half-siblings. She got it worse because she was white and no one threatened to rescue her from his claws. Growing up, Glory felt unloved because to her mother, love was finite. Her father was rarely in the picture. The more children she had, the less love she had to give. You would think that Glory, being the oldest, would get the most love simply because they'd been together longer and had been through so much together. But no, with each new child, the affection for the previous one was clipped like the skin of circumcision and discarded in quite the same way. There were five that were born. Unfortunately, by the time the last one came, a shift happened. After his cuteness wore off, he was just as unloved as the first two children. And that's what it looked like.
I heard this speaker one time. That just reminded me of this really great sentence. This speaker I heard, she opened up with, before I tell you about my childhood, let me tell you about my mother's. And I thought that was really gracious.
So, and she had a lot of trauma. She had a lot of
trauma. Yeah. Yeah. So you were raised in an environment where love was finite, and how did that translate? What you were saying basically is that the attempts to kind of get ahead through illegitimate means or unlawful means was really this search for love being masked as this sort of
need,
or almost like illicit entrepreneurship.
Because all the love that I had was poured into my children, and the goal, I'm using air quotes for goal, but the goal was trying to give them a better life experience than I had.
So in your mind at that time, why not pursue legitimate means? Was it a financial thing? Like, well, a more above board job wouldn't pay as well, wouldn't be as quick as a quick fix. What was the thinking behind always pursuing these scammy means, as you call them?
I didn't have the mindset for playing the long game at the time. I only knew instant gratification and short-term fixes. I only knew that. Well, first of all, my temporal lobe isn't even fully formed. Let's just start right there. You know what I mean?
What age does that become formed? Something really late.
It's like you're 21? You're like 21, 22-ish.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm not even, like we talk about grown. Girl, you're not grown. You still got a soft spot. Knock it off. You know? and so, for me, I didn't have that yet. I didn't have that realization of, and I always wanted to go to college, but I'm not going with three kids. You know, that's out of the question.
So and zero budget.
Zero budget. Like, I'm on my own trying to make it work out here in these streets. And then with no formal education and everyone around you doing some of the same thing. So I was just mired in this environment of trying to find a way, trying to find a way, trying to find a way. And I'm so glad that I got on my personal growth journey when I did, because it literally changed the trajectory of my life. And after a while, I started to trust myself, which allowed the people around me to trust me. And then because I wasn't the person to do scammy things anymore, you know, but I had ruined a lot of relationships in the process, not because I took from my friends, but just the idea. So just think, if you and I are friends now, right? And I tell you, girl, I'm about to go and buy these gift cards, these half price gift cards. What does that do for my trust? Even though I'm not doing anything to you, you wouldn't trust me as far as you could throw me, you know, and that's normal.
I guess it would depend on whether I was of the same mentality. So tell us, who were you surrounding? I'm really always curious about relationships, because relationships set the scene or are part of the fiber of your life and your lifestyle at any given age. So what did your relationships look like?
My relationships looked like more people like me. So I didn't have examples of the life that I was actually trying to achieve. And I was on some suck it type stuff, meaning I'm going to be better than you. My kids are not going to experience abuse. My kids are not going to experience, I'm going to love my children. Oprah Winfrey taught me to hug and kiss my children and do it until it felt good. You know, do it until it felt normal. Because we weren't hugged and kissed. We weren't told we were loved as kids. And so I didn't want my kids to have that experience. So even now, if I'm in the house with my children, they're getting in my bed. Or, you know what I mean? Like, they're hugging on me or wanting to sit right next to me. They're like, Jen, can I sit there? If you're sitting next to me, one of my kids walks in. I'm like, Jen, can I sit right there?
Yeah.
So, but that came from me instituting this practice of affection early on, and I learned it from daytime television.
Really? Yeah. What did she say specifically?
She said that it was a normal thing in Black families for, you know, love not to be expressed, and we have to change that narrative. So she said what she learned was to embrace that it was okay to embrace and be embraced. It was okay to kiss and be kissed. It was okay to say, I love you. And she said, don't raise your children without those things, because there's a level of validation that they're going to need. And it starts at home. You don't want them to get the validation from outside of the home, because then what happens is the loudest roar in your children's lives is going to be the voice that is guiding them. And you want that to be start from home.
This is hitting me really hard, but continue.
So I had to learn that. But along with that, so it was like while I was learning these lessons, I still had not learned. That's why everything that we do, you'll see me say, okay, this is what we want to do by this date. And then I'll reverse engineer it to make that thing possible so that we can actually execute on that thing. I didn't have that language or that knowledge back then. So I was trying to make these long jumps, and every time I fell in the pit, every single time I fell in the pit, I went to jail. You know, it was like all these things. I would fall in a pit because I knew what I was envisioning, but how to get there was so foreign to me. It was unreal. And so I felt like I was just in this cycle of bringing myself out. But what I think I saw and I didn't have the language for was there was a light on me of possibility. There was a light on me of strength and of you know, just all these things. But I didn't know how to cultivate it. I had zero idea how to cultivate that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why now you can't stop me until I realize the dream.
You say I wanna be the hero.
have so many questions.
I know.
So the first question I have is regarding expressing affection at home. I can really relate to that. Just not feeling treasured, cherished.
Mm-hmm.
And then going outside of your home to find that. Mm-hmm. And the way that that manifested for me is sleeping with like 60, 70 people in an attempt to mm-hmm. find substitute love, you know? That's for another day. But what did it feel like when you said you had to do it until it felt right? What did it feel like initially to express physical love when you had never experienced that?
It felt like I was a cartoon character and my baby was a human.
Huh.
That sounds crazy.
That sounds really interesting. Tell me more.
So it was as if it did not feel real. It did not feel normal. Like, you know how when the baby is a baby, it's just natural for you to hug and kiss on it because you just love this bundle of joy.
Yeah.
But now when your baby is 5 and 6, you're just like issuing orders and you're like, come on in so we can put your shoes on. Like, I was a kind mother. I wasn't an mm-hmm. affectionate mother. You know, I was kind. I fed the kids. Like, they took baths every night. Like, they got dressed. They had haircuts and, you know, like, I did what I was supposed to do as a mother. But I didn't even know that the affection piece was a thing. Mm. That's how ignorant I was. Mm. I didn't have the language for what I was, the void that I was trying to fill was that on the inside of me. That's why at 15 years old, I was sleeping around with their dad.
Mm.
Because I'm looking for love in all the wrong places, honey, Chad.
Yes.
And let me tell you, it was not all it was cracked up to be, but I thought it was the cream of the crop. It was everything because it was more than I had ever experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of my grandma, but you feel like grandmas are supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to love you.
Yeah, you were chosen. It's different when you're chosen.
When you're chosen. And so it was different, not knowing that I was getting 10% of who he was because he was, girl, doing his own thing. But I was so young and so innocent, you know, and silly. I didn't know. And so the sun rose and set on him for me. And then, so having these kids and, you know, I had them, I cared for them, did the best I could for them. I worked hard for them. I needed them to see and know that, but I didn't know how to be affectionate toward them. So initially, the first hugs and just sitting in the affection, like I remember my son was sitting on the couch and I said, come sit with me. And he was like, okay. And so he sat next to me and then I said, no, sit on my lap. And then he sat on my lap, but he was sitting up straight, like his back was straight. Like he wasn't leaning on me.
Mm.
And then what happened is, and it was weird at first, and then eventually while we were watching television, he sat back. Then he snuggled, right? But the thing is, it got comfortable for us both.
Yeah.
And then I just never allowed that separation to come back. And so they felt love. And so it was funny because as a grown man, he's the oldest child. As a grown man, I have to tell him, must you be up under me, sir? You're 6'2". Can you go sit somewhere else? You know, because it was cultivated over years.
That is my dream of motherhood. I was just talking to an old friend of mine from high school. She has kids who are 3 sons who are a little bit older than my kids. And she said, I have to go because I have to go get into bed with my son. And then she said, don't judge me. And I said, judge you. That is my dream scenario, to be physically affectionate with my children, because I was raised in a similar situation to you, in the sense that love was not, I didn't grow up feeling like it was finite, but I definitely grew up feeling that it was conditional. and conditions of worth. And then even if the conditions were met, there wasn't much love coming at me. You know, there was no physical affection. There was no hugs, no kisses, no saying I love you.
Mm-hmm.
So my fear, I think, as a mom now is that I have that touch thing still. And so it's really cool to hear you talk about overcoming it, because I'm, to this day, if someone were to sit down next to me on the couch and their leg was touching mine just casually, my entire being and 100% of my attention would go to that point of contact on my leg. Everything else would be out the window. Whatever movie we're watching or TV we were watching would be gone. The whole environment would fade into nothingness. And all I would be able to think is, how am I going to get my leg away from theirs so that I, without hurting their feelings?
Wow.
That's how not comfortable with touch I am, which is so, like, ironic. I don't know if I'm using that word the right way, but given how much random sex I've had with people. But
yeah.
The intimacy, non-sexual intimacy, is because sexual intimacy was motivated by a lot of things, in particular getting a high energetically and physically, but I can relate to that so deeply. So it is really fascinating for me to hear about how you acknowledged that and then how you overcame it and how that has lasted to this day, that your kids still feel comfortable in the realm of physical touch with you, even as adults.
Absolutely. And I think it's great for us to be having this conversation because your children are so small.
Yeah.
So you get to activate this even earlier than I did, so that your experience might even be better than mine later, you know? And I think that's a beautiful thing. And that is what I strive for in my life, like changing the narrative for others. Like, I overcame this thing, and this is how, and I hope it works for you too.
Yeah.
I know it will. If you're committed to it, you know? If you're committed to it.
And your awareness of it, you're bringing that awareness to it. I didn't receive this. There's an acceptance here of, I didn't receive this, and that's not going to limit me going forward. That's what I love about you. You're not a victim. You never are a victim.
No.
And someone said to me, I like to speak about recovery pretty inclusively, and I heard someone say one time, victims don't recover.
That's true. Because we're still self-traumatizing every time we relive that thing or those things over and over. We're re-attacking ourselves every time. And so there's no room for healing.
Yeah, with fixed, you know, the past is fixed and it's complex. One day we'll have to have, you know, I don't feel informed enough to speak on that, but one day maybe we can have somebody on who's really an expert in that, who can teach us about
absolutely
the impact it has on different levels. So, of course, I'm dying to know what happened. I know you're not going to think I forgot that you just said you went to jail. You've never told me the story. I just want to put it out there. Just like, I like to keep it fresh. And also, you know how I found out about it?
How?
I Googled you. And we were already friends.
And
I came across it accidentally. I don't even remember what I was doing, looking for your website or something. Like, and you had just never mentioned it. And we were years deep into this friendship. And then you've mentioned it sort of in passing a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is a huge part of your story because you've told me about the impact it had upon you. But do you care? And I don't want to pressure you in any way, but do you care to share with
us? I have no problem sharing, although this is going to be a longer episode. I'm just going to say that. And okay. I just also want to say that we've already been into the second part of our segment, which is called Supporting Each Other's Healing Journeys. If we haven't been doing that, I don't know what is. So this is well into the second segment.
We'll just do it live in real time.
We're doing it in real time. And so when I was 22 years old, the kids were very small. So they were like 3, 5, and 7. And I was in such a desperation. I was getting ready to get put out of my apartment. And I was just tired of accepting the crumbs off of, how I describe it, is accepting the crumbs off someone else's table. I worked, but it just wasn't enough for a family of four. And their dad helped, but it wasn't like real help. Just say that, right? And so you're talking about two hood kids trying to raise kids, you know? Mm. So I decided that I was going to do something about my situation once and for all. And I, in all my brilliance, decided to rob a department store. And it was January. Yeah, wasn't that a great idea? it was January, and a friend of mine worked at the store, and she kept saying how Brinks kept missing the pickup from all of those holiday sales. So it was like hundreds of thousands of dollars in the store. And she's just talking from her, just friends talking. She was not trying to coerce anything, nothing like that. Just like talking about her work day, like we do. And in my mind, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the answer to all of my problems.
This is an opportunity to change everything.
This changes everything. I could pay the rent. I could get ahead in the rent, and we could just finally have this desperation off of us. It was like I was in such a cycle of desperation. It was like you clear out one issue and here's another. Uniforms, or, you know, school fees, or, you know, the car breaks down, or the rent is due. Or my sister had a sick child. They were living with me. And so it was just so much. When I think about how much was on my little self, you know,
mm-hmm. Your 22-year-old self.
22-year-old self. I should have been on a college campus living my best life.
Right.
Instead, I was taking care of the world. And so I decided to do this. And so it's like it took weeks of planning. And then when I talked to other people who had done things, I had never done anything like this. Even the little things that I did, I never did anything. I was like the secondhand person. Just say that. I wasn't like a criminal, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like there's a difference. Like, I was the person that would buy a gift card from you or buy some stolen goods, but I wasn't going to go steal anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I feel like it's all the same. The way I look at it now, it's all the same. And so I decided to do this. And then I recruited some people and made this big old elaborate plan and did it. And I'd never... It's so weird. I can't believe I did it. Luckily, I didn't get caught at the scene. I got caught much later because the two of them got caught at the scene. And they, of course, told the exact same story. So by the time they caught up with me, there was no need for me to say anything as if
they both ratted you out.
Oh, totally. And so I got the most time. I ended up getting 9 years.
Did you get 9 years because you had a weapon?
Yeah, we had weapons.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So did you get the money and succeed initially, but only they got caught on the scene and you got away? Wow. So you
But the thing is, no, but when we went to leave the building, SWAT and every police official was outside the doors. So I had to slip out with the cleaning crew. I had a change of clothes.
Crew?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I acted like I was a person that worked there.
Did you have a mask?
All that stuff was hidden. It was a mall. All that stuff was hidden.
You had a mask on during the act.
Yes, I did.
And then you had a bag and you had a gun, presumably.
And I had a change of clothes.
And then you just ran out the door with did the money go in the bag? This is like a movie.
It went in a underneath the trash can. So I pulled up the trash can lid, pulled up the bag, put the money underneath, and then put the lid back on. I hid the gun in a pair of pants pocket, a pocket of a pair of trousers in the store.
Okay.
And changed my clothes and walked out shivering. I'm shaking as they assumed in fear, but I'm shaking that I'm not found out.
Wait, where was the trash can that the money went into to hide it?
Inside the mall.
So in somewhere else in the mall that you would then retrieve it later?
Yes.
Okay. So you walked out completely empty-handed, just with a different change of clothes, no gun, no money.
Nothing.
Ooh. And then what was the plan to go back and get the money?
I had to send someone because I got arrested that night. But, I had to send stuff. So they never found any of that. But still, because those two testimonies were so,
identical.
They were so accurate. Like, they told a joke that I told en route to the mall. They both told the same joke.
Oh, my God. Wait, so why did you get the most time?
Because I was the air quote mastermind.
Oh. So they put the whole thing on you? Was it actually all on you, too? Like, was that accurate?
I feel like, because the other girl was the girl that worked there. So I feel like we both were equally, but whatever.
She know you were going to do it?
She was a part of it. That's how I got in. That's how I got into the money.
Oh, so you weren't, like, sticking anybody up. She was just giving you the cash, and she knew you were on the way.
Right.
Interesting.
But the thing is, it was still grace. Even though I got 9 years, I could have gotten 25 years to life easy because my charges were robbery and kidnapping. Because I moved two people from the first floor to the second floor.
That is ridiculous. I'm sorry. Yeah. That is ridiculous. That was ridiculous. Those are adults.
That was considered kidnapping. What? I had a gun, remember? So it's kidnapping.
What? But weren't they in on it? How's that kidnapping?
No, not the two people. These were two workers that I encountered in the elevator. So moving them from one floor to the next was considered kidnapping. And so I could have easily gotten kidnapping alone like that holds 25 to life.
So you encountered these store employees in the elevator randomly?
Yes, because you can't account for everybody that's cleaning up the store at 6 o'clock in the morning.
And then did they know what had happened?
They knew, but they didn't know if I was a girl or a boy. I never said anything. You know what I mean? The other guy was a guy, so he spoke, you know? So it was just this whole thing. And
that sounds like a disaster, yeah.
That's a whole thing inside this book, too. That's a whole, the chapter. But that being said, the fact that my life circumstances made me think that that was okay. That was the only choice I had.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even question that, though, because that mindset to me makes sense. The act itself is almost just a symptom of the mindset. The mindset is that state of desperation, that state of hopelessness, that state of trying and trying and trying to get somewhere and not being able to get anywhere. And then this carrot is dangled in front of you. Mm-hmm. If I just had this amount of money. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm a judgment-free zone. I'm thinking this is a victimless crime. You know, it's not, I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, but it's not really, I know it sounds silly to say this, but it's not really violent. Like, to me, that's not violent. To me, that's just a young, lost person trying to make things right for her family from a really, you know, effed up state of mind and really foolish thing to do. But I understand where you were coming from, I guess is what I'm saying. You got these three little ones and you just cannot find a way to make ends meet. And then it's like there's this opportunity that comes and you're already conditioned for these opportunities, not to mention the messaging of that you were raised with, which is people who are successful got around the law somehow.
Yeah. So it was a tipping point for me.
Yeah.
And using the Malcolm Gladwell language, it was definitely a tipping point for me because what I knew was this could not be the future of my children. It was the worst thing that could have ever happened to me. It was the worst vision I could ever show my children. And if yeah. I could avoid them having this experience at all cost, it would be the very thing that I dedicated my life to. So yeah. while having my children early, according to my mother, and that was just nothing but shame. Like, you bring shame, you know, even though I was born at exactly the same time in her life. But mm-hmm. what's the never, you know?
Yeah.
What's the never? Everything was so much worse when I did it, you know? And I was just following in these cycles, even though mine were just bigger and magnified. And I feel that when you have a light on your life the way I believe that I do, of course I'm going to get caught the first time I commit a crime, because I know what I know about Bettina Lynette McGatney. I could have never gotten away with that because I would have lived a life of crime.
Yes, I thought I was
smarter than everybody.
Yeah.
And I outsmarted the system and all yep. these things. So I'm grateful that yes. I got caught. I was talking to my daughter about this, and I said, I know you're probably not going to understand this, but I believe my getting caught and going to jail, while it changed your life, because guess what? My children had to go live in that same house with my mom, which, Lord, that would have been the last thing I wanted. You know what I mean? But it mm-hmm. beats going in the system, you know?
Yeah. So you swear to yourself you're not going to repeat history, and then suddenly the gates are clanging shut and you have landed your kids in your literal growing up environment.
Literal.
Oh,
right?
My God. I can't even imagine what you were going through in your little...
In my mind.
Little young person mind, because you're still a baby in my mind in this story.
Oh, yeah. When you think about someone that's 23, you're a kid. You're a whole kid.
Who's had kids since they're 16. So whatever personal development you may or may not have done at that time was sort of postponed.
Absolutely.
Because of full-on motherhood activities.
Yep.
yeah.
Your focus has to be on raising these babies. And yeah. so that was, but what I just promised myself that this wasn't going to be that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The great thing was I had a date. And I needed to work on being the best version of myself between now and then. And so that was actually how I found the dental industry, because I thought I wanted to be a dentist, but being in somebody's mouth is the most disgusting thing ever for me. And so people are so nasty. You know how I am. People yeah. don't take care of their mouths.
Even when they do, it's still gross.
It's very gross. And so
it's a lot.
I thought that was the, you know, the axiom of dentistry. But then I found dental technology, and there was this Black man that ran, and his name was Mr. Slack, and he's still a mentor today, and I love him. But Luther Slack, I remembered going into this program, because one thing about being in jail or in prison, the work that you do is total servitude. Like, you make pennies, literally pennies. And you know that wasn't going to work for me. And so I wanted to jump
you
the
line.
You make what? Pennies.
Oh, pennies?
Literal pennies.
What
15
do you
cents
mean?
An hour, 21 oh. cents an hour, 19 cents an hour.
Oh my gosh, really?
Oh my gosh, it's shameful. Oh. And so... That's why the prison industry is so has gotten privatized, because it's free labor.
Mm-hmm.
It's free labor of hundreds of thousands of people, millions of
Don't
people.
Don't even get me started.
It's so sad. And so, but that was never going to work for me because I'm Bettina. And so I needed a career. I couldn't do gardening work or landscaping work or construction work. I knew my brain was bigger than that. And not to put anything against anybody else. I just knew that that wasn't my life, my reality, and that wasn't going to feed my kids. And so I went to meet the man that was running the dental program. And I said to him, I said, I kept harassing him every time I would see him. When I found out who he was, I harassed him every day. I would see him and I would say, Mr. Slack, are you going to give me an interview? And he was like, no. He said, the interview has hundreds of lifers, people that are going to be here for the rest of their lives on the list before you. I don't even know who you are. And so, no. And he would tell me that every day, every time I saw him. And then finally, I said, Mr. Slack, I've really been studying and I really need a career to be able to take care of my kids when I get out of here. And I only have a few more years. You've got to help me. He said, come to my office on Friday at 2:00. And he gave me whatever paper I needed to be able to get to that side. And when he interviewed me, he asked me if I knew the numbers of the teeth. I didn't. He asked me if I knew the upper from the lower or the maxilla from the mandible. I didn't. He asked me if I knew the different tooth function. I didn't. He said, so why should I hire you? And I said, because I'm going to come in here and give you 100% of me, 110% of me. And if you don't like me or I don't like this, I will leave quietly and never bother you again. And he said, you start on Monday. And I parlayed that into a 20-year career. And I literally learned everything. I was a total sponge and he loved my passion and my energy and you know how I am. So I was like his star pupil and he was just an older man that wanted someone that wasn't scheming or scamming, that really wanted to learn because he had so much to teach. And he taught me for 4 years and he told me to go to LACC. There was already a spot for me in the program. They were actually holding that spot for me. And I got into that program and it was a rigorous 2-year program. I worked from 7 to 4 at a dental lab and I was in school from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Friday, no holidays.
Damn.
And that was my life for 2 years. And it was nothing but the hand of God that kept me because on Friday nights, my kids lived in Ontario. I lived in Los Angeles. My kids lived in Ontario. I told my mother a year from my date, my release, that I was going to get my kids because I needed to get a car, get an apartment, all that stuff. And I told her a year from today, I'm going to get my kids. And she fully expected that I wouldn't because I was supposed to be a Section 8 welfare person. You know, after having a prison stint, like, who do you think you are? Which is my family's favorite phrase for me. Who do you think you are? And so I was supposed to be underneath. I was supposed to just succumb to a life of poverty. And I refused it because these children needed to see something. And so I finished that program. And on Friday nights, I would have to drive from school straight to Ontario. Mind you, I am beat down tired from working these long hours every day. And I had to drive. Sometimes I would fall asleep on the freeway going and coming. And it was nothing but I used to cry so bad because I was like, God, you just got to wake me up. Help me, please. Don't let me kill my kids. All this and that. He covered me for 2 years doing that. Yep. That was my life. And so I would be with the kids all weekend from Friday night to Sunday, late Sunday. I would drop them off back in Ontario. And I did that for 2 years.
Where's
really
Ontario?
For 1 year. Ontario is in the IE, so it's in the Inland Empire.
Okay.
So you're looking at right at the 60 and the 15 freeway.
Is that as if you would go out to Palm Springs or is that as
Palm
if you would
Springs
go
is
north?
Much further.
Okay, okay.
Same direction, so, just much further.
Okay.
So, but it was far enough,
Well, especially with that traffic, Jesus.
That
Friday,
traffic.
Friday traffic, are you joking? It takes 2 hours to get across town on a Friday.
Absolutely. More. So I'm in every Friday night, I'm in Vegas traffic. Every Friday night.
Oh, you gotta be kidding me.
Every Friday night.
No.
I was in Vegas traffic.
Oh my God.
And so I was falling asleep. I was so tired. Oh. It was amazing. But God helped me. He held me. I never had one accident. Never had one accident with by myself or with those kids in the car. And so I did that for 1 year because a year to the date, like I said, I got my kids. And then after that, but for a year, I was still in school and, you know, doing all the things. But it worked. It just worked. It just worked. And I feel like this podcast is going to come out and my former employees are going to be like, what?
I was actually thinking that. Yeah.
But
they're like, you got educated where?
But it worked and it was a beautiful thing. And it was the launch pad for that career. And it changed. I did break a lot of cycles. I wanted my kids to not be teenage parents. I wanted them to never go to jail, or especially prison, never go to jail, prison. I didn't want them to not feel loved. I didn't want to continue the cycle of abuse so my kids weren't beaten and all that. They weren't my slaves. You know what I mean? And so they got to become who they were meant to become. And so I feel like I won, even with that being the backdrop of my story. I still won. I still won, and it's a beautiful thing.
You are the coolest person I know.
You're so funny.
That was an amazing story. And two things are jumping out to me. Number one is that full circle moment of little Bettina, still 14 in her mind, 8 years later, coming up to Luther and saying, just please give me a chance. Just please give me a chance to learn.
And he did.
And him saying no, which was what happened last time. And yeah. Then you have progressed enough to say, I'm not taking no for an answer.
Exactly.
That's what's so incredible.
I love that because I didn't see it.
You had gotten to the next level without even knowing it. Mm. And then the other thing that's bringing this home for me, which is a perfect way to wrap up, is in the beginning, I asked you, what's driving you the way that you are with these deadlines? And then something you said with that prison sentence, 9 years, and you said, for the first time in my life, I'm, you know, taking liberties with what you said, but for the first time in my life, I had a date. And yeah. I could reverse engineer me becoming the person I needed to be in that mm-hmm. time period. And you had, you know, really no excuses, nothing else going on. You had mm-hmm. been, your sort of journey into crime or shortcuts had been nipped in the bud because you mm-hmm. got caught the first time you tried something major. And then you got a date and you had to change course, reverse engineer your best self to arrive on that date. And that's why you are the way you are. And I feel like
that's
I know
exactly
you so
why.
Much better now.
After 10 years, Jen, really?
Yes. Well, now when you call me and you're like, okay, well, the date is this. Did we do all the things that were on the list? I get it. This is what your fiber of your being is built around.
Yeah, it is. It is.
That
it's
is
about,
so cool.
And it's about making forward progress at all times. Like, I can't, stagnation, I've never felt good in the middle. Right. I've never felt good in the middle either. It's like lovely and I'm experiencing the best of everything, but I've learned to get comfortable in the middle because I can look over what I've achieved. Like even on a Wednesday when I'm tired and I'm like, oh, how much longer, right? And I look over what I've done this week, or there's a top in Asana that says, how many tasks have you completed? And that is so satisfying for me. It's satisfying because I know that I am slowly moving towards what I'm working on, and I'm learning to enjoy the journey. Like, the things that I find joy in today is so weird, and they're so simple, and you would never think it's my truth, but just reading a book, you know, learning something new, you know, having special time with my friends, having conversations with my friends, you know, it's the little things. And I was always a big thing. Everything had to be big. The experience had to be big. The money had to be big, and it has to be right now, you know, but I'm learning to bask in simplicity and in the middle, and not because the middle for me only works because I can look over what I've done the last month or the last week or the last 2 days and say, I'm satisfied with that. And so I can rest in where I am in this moment.
Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up this topic by saying, also full circle, I just realized another growth marker that ties in with what you were saying. So one of the things I admire about you the most is how you do work really hard, but you also, when you speak about your home life and when you speak about your kids and when you speak about cooking, you also have this really full-hearted experience of joy that I feel like, as a very reserved person, I can't often tap into. It's hard also for me to rest and hard for me to be in a state of uninhibited anything, but especially joy and pleasure, and that's hard. And I really love that about you, that you, when you do pivot to move, because I'm very deadline driven at work and in, you know, in certain ways, and when you do decide to pivot and have people over for a poker night or decorate your house or all these things you've told me you've done over the years, you are so full on with the experience of that thing. And that's something that I'm really looking to improve upon. So my tiny little moment of progress this morning, I went to the gym and I arrived on time, accountability check-in, because Herschel got me out the door. He was involved. But anyway, I took the help. I need the help. And I got out the door and I got to the gym and my class had been canceled. And so, of course, I'm not going to work out. I'm not in the mood for that. I have to have the good things. I'm not self-motivated. So the class being gone is like, now it's time to leave, you know? And so, but the thing is that I didn't leave right away. There are these chairs that I had my eye on. I wasn't sure what they are. Were they massage chairs? Were they something? My friend had told me they're amazing. They're always booked up. People are always in there and waiting in line. And so I said to myself, you know what? Why don't you sit in that chair for 5 minutes and do nothing? Or it's a 15-minute session. So I got in there. I said I would do 15. I said, jump into that chair and just do nothing for 15 minutes. Got into the chair. Turns out it's not a massage chair. So that was, you know, let down. And then it also turned out it was this cryo chair. So that means it gets cold.
Oh.
I don't like cold. So I made it about, I think I was there for 5 minutes. But the point is, I did nothing for 5 minutes. And I tried to enjoy it, but the cold wasn't enjoyable. But I stopped everything. I didn't just run home and jump right back into work.
Right.
I just stopped. And I took 5 minutes to do nothing. And that was a win. And with that,
Major,
we are way deep into the time again here. So why don't we?
I know. Well, wait. Before we go into that, let's just do one thing, because I don't want to miss this.
Okay.
Can you give me in 1 minute for the life focus question? Can you give me in 1 minute how you find clarity and strength in sobriety?
Oh, well, not trashing my body every day with drugs and alcohol actually comes with a surprising amount of clarity. So that's a no-brainer. I was reflecting on this morning, and I used to think there was a lot of freedom in being out of control, meaning drinking too much and sort of checking out through mostly weed and sometimes other things. I was building a cage of my own making without even realizing it. In this attempt to enjoy myself, in this attempt to be more uninhibited than I am naturally, I was forging the weapon, the boomerang that would turn in mid-flight and come back and cut me to ribbons. So everything I was doing to try to find a shortcut to freedom was actually building a prison of my own making, which meaning that because of the progression of drug addiction and alcoholism, I lost the power of choice in whether or not I would drink or smoke or whatever I was doing. So getting out and away from that and making the decision to actually become clear-eyed was the best decision I ever made, even though it was extremely uncomfortable initially. It got me out of this jail that I had created for myself. So clarity is clarity has a lot of different definitions, but in the literal sense, I'm as clean as I'm ever going to be. So it comes back then to me, to emotional sobriety. When my vision is clouded by the noise, the things that, as you say, are taking up mental and emotional real estate, I'm not clear and I'm not sober. No matter how sober I am physically, I can easily go into emotional drunkenness at any time. So that's what I have to say if we're talking about a 1 minute time limit.
And for me, I love that. And for me, I feel like I've turned that go, go, go. Remember when I was in my personal insobriety or my emotional, instability, I was trying to move forward in an unhealthy way. So I was trying to gain traction illegally or, just trying to get
quicksand.
But now I'm okay with the long route. Like, I'm comfortable in the long road. And I think that that brings so much clarity because it took me a long time to realize the areas where my capacity has actually increased. And now that I see it, I feel like a superhero in a different way. I feel like before I felt like a superhero, it was like that childish way where I was like wearing a cape and I'm trying to save everybody, trying to save myself, but it was getting me nowhere fast. This time around, I feel a little bit superhero-ish, but it's on solid ground, and I am the light for my family. I am a matriarch in a family with a whole person, older person that's alive that should be taking the role. But I'm comfortably taking that role because I like who I am. I love what I have to offer. And there's a lot of clarity that I can bring and freedom that I can bring to my family members that decide to get on board. So it's beautiful.
And it's beautiful to me to hear you valuing yourself like that. That is so beautiful to hear you just say, yeah, I am worth that. Yeah, I did work hard. Yeah, I am that thing that I've always wanted to be. And that is incredible.
So now let's quickly wrap up for our recipe for today. We're doing non-alcoholic celebration drinks because I feel like we should celebrate.
We should celebrate. Celebrate more.
Tell me what you have for your celebration, your non-alcoholic celebration drink.
So I'm just going classic. My kids, or at least my daughter, loves Mickey Mouse. And at first I was like, ugh, the Mickey Mouse color scheme. It doesn't fit into my house at all. It's a red and it's a pink for the mini. I don't like red or pink. But the thing with Mickey Mouse, if they're going to pick something, is Mickey Mouse is tried and true. Mickey Mouse is old as heck. It feels weird to not be cursing, but I'm sticking with it. So my recipe is one of my favorite things still to this day, and it actually is a throwback to little girlhood, is I love a Shirley Temple. Do you know what that is?
Oh, cute. With
it's the
tomato?
Best. No tomato.
What's a
no.
Shirley Temple? I thought it was tomato juice.
No.
Okay, you gotta tell me juice. Then.
Okay. So whenever I was at a restaurant when I was little, they would let me order a Shirley Temple. And I feel like it's very old New York. That might not even be true, but that's just what I associate it with. It feels fancy. It's a cocktail for a little kid. It's made of ginger ale. So as a sober person, I do not drink alcohol. And so my go-to drink is either a seltzer with cranberry and lime, or I'll just do a soda. I just love soda. I love the way it tastes. Pepsi, ginger ale, whatever you got. I like a soda. It's really decadent, actually, if you really hone in on it. So what we do with the Shirley Temple is it's ginger ale. I think it can be Sprite too, but I'm just going to tell you how I make it. It's ginger ale with grenadine and a cherry. So a maraschino cherry. So I actually made it yesterday in preparation for this episode.
I love it.
Grenadine in the fridge. So grenadine, I looked this up this morning. I've never known what's in it. It's pink. So it makes the ginger ale fun and celebratory. So it's a pink liquid, and it's actually made of pomegranate. I just found that out today. It's made of pomegranate. It's extremely sweet. So you have to sort of sweeten to taste. I'm not a huge sweet person. I find ginger already to be pretty sweet. So I just add a splash of grenadine, and you throw a couple cherries in there if you're feeling fancy.
Nice.
That's it. The end.
I love it. I'm going to make it because that's so simple.
Fun.
And I have all the ingredients in my bar.
You have grenadine in your fridge?
I do, because I like grenadine. I like grenadine in my Coronas. Is that weird?
Really? Oh, that's cute.
When I drink
cute.
A Corona, I have to have a splash of grenadine in
that
it, and I'll drop
really
a slice
cute.
Of lemon inside.
I like that lemon,
that
too,
girl.
Not lime. Really?
Yes.
I just keep learning more and more about you. Okay, hit me with your recipe.
Okay,
hit
so
me.
I told you about my girl group that I hang around with, and I was known for my jungle juice. So we're going to do a non-alcoholic version. So I cut up a lot of lemons, oranges, and strawberries, because jungle juice has fruit in it. And so you cut the fruit up, put it in a big, like a punch bowl. And in that, I pour lemonade, orange juice, cranberry juice, and fruit punch, and also some club soda to give it a little bit of hizzy, you know? Now, normally this would also include some Bacardi and some vodka, but we're not doing that, right?
Yeah.
And so you mix that up really good, and that's your drink. Like, and you have like a piece of fruit on your glass. It's cute. But what I always loved about jungle juice was, even when it was full of alcohol back in the day, it would sneak up on you. So it was just comfortable, and it was cute to drink because you have fruit in your glass. And I'm the girl. I'll freeze some grapes and just throw them in the bottom of my wine glass. So I like fruit on the side of my glass, or I like to have a little. I'm extra. You know that about me. I'm extra. Give me a slice of fruit on my glass and I'm happy. But my non-alcoholic would be that, because it's fruity. It has a lot of flavor. It gives you a little bit of fizz, but not too much. And the kids love it. The kids love it, and the adults love it as well. So that's my wrap. So this was an amazing episode. I cannot believe you made me cry. I cannot believe you had me ugly crying on this call today.
No.
But I am so glad we did it. This was amazing.
Me too.
And thank you for hearing me and loving me and all that stuff.
Always. And thank you, everyone. If anyone made it this deep into this episode, thank you so much for joining us. We love each and every one of you, and there's nothing you can do about it. Peace.
We love you. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the What's the Temp podcast. Be great on purpose.
This the overcomer's anthem. Moving mountains and dancing. Got the keys to the kingdom. So by faith we already won. Whole squad got a war.